Welcome to this edition of World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley speaking to you from Washington, D.C. Now let's go immediately in medias res. After this tumultuous week, we ought now, I think, to try to offer a comprehensive, or as comprehensive as we can make it, judgment of what it is that has occurred, what the strategic implications are, and what people of goodwill need to do. Because responding to these things is sure, to some extent, a matter of analysis, but it's above all a matter of action. It is not enough to know or to believe. One must act. The good works are necessary. Knowledge or faith alone will not do it. You will not be saved by that. It's got to be actions. Now, we look at these Paris attacks, and it seems to me that we are quite possibly in the presence of a phase change in the internal dynamics of terrorism, just as over the time period of September, October, we began to see a change in the mechanics of the world process. And this, of course, has to do with the Russian presence in Syria, but also a series of other events, right? Faction fights here in Washington, the refugee crisis striking Europe, and many other things. But when it comes to terrorism, here is what I would recommend. The more or less automatic analytical concepts that have been in force for the past 15 or so years, in other words, since about 9/11, September 11th, 2001, I think some of those concepts are now obsolete. And I say this as probably the individual who's done more than any other to create these concepts and to spread them. I've got here a copy of the fifth edition of my book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in USA. And if we look at chapter two, and I think this is pretty similar in the other editions, that one is called The Theory and Practice of Synthetic Terrorism. And right there, I tell you, the original title for this chapter was The Theory and Practice of State-Sponsored False Flag Synthetic Terrorism. Call it synthetic terrorism for short. And I go on to say, this terrorism is synthetic because it brings together the efforts of a number of disparate components: patsies, moles, professionals, media, and controllers. It is also synthetic in the sense that it is artificial. It does not grow up spontaneously out of despair, oppression, or anything of the kind, but it is rather the product of an effort of organization and direction in which factions of intelligence agencies and governments play the indispensable role. Now, that was 9/11. That was false flag, meaning that the world was told Bin Laden, Osama bin Laden in a cave, and the 19 hijackers, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and Ramzi bin al-Shib, and Mohammed Atta, and Hani Hanjour, and Jarrah, and the rest of them, they did this. Well, of course, they couldn't do it. And the big effort, the big point was, they lacked the physical capability to do it. It was out of the question. It was like Dallas with Lee Harvey Oswald and all those shots in so little time hitting President Kennedy. But at the same time, I always pointed out, Al-Qaeda exists, and they can blow up a supermarket or a bus. And, of course, if you get a lot of Al-Qaeda together, they can blow up a lot of buses and a lot of supermarkets, and they can take over a city or maybe even a region. The one thing that they could not do was to orchestrate 9/11. But now, have not things changed? I think they have. And I would point in particular to the testimony of General Lloyd Austin, the U.S. CENTCOM commander here in Washington around the middle of August, I guess it was, where poor General Austin was forced to admit that after $500 million of expenditure, the U.S. had been unable to field more than half a dozen moderate terrorists or moderate terrorist patsies in Syria. So it meant that the holdings of the U.S. in the patsy milieu had been radically reduced. And I think you have to interpret that broadly in the sense that what Austin was pointing to was a fact that the U.S. terrorist franchise, the CIA and Pentagon terrorist franchise, had been radically depleted. So now we get the Paris attacks, and here's what I would say. There were a lot of people who were calling this false flag before there was any flag. The flag goes up either when somebody claims it, or the media say it, or a government says it, or what have you. And a lot of people were already chanting false flag, before any of that had happened. So I think what this means is a conceptual abuse. And in particular, two terms, gladio and false flag, it seems to me are not relevant, or not very relevant to what happened here in Paris. So I would say it is certainly state-sponsored terrorism. ISIS is a state. It controls territory. It has armed forces. It has intelligence, maybe not agencies, but it has intelligence divisions. And their specialty is, of course, this kind of blind terrorism, right? This sort of indiscriminate killing. That is what they do. So they've now exported that to Paris. And to other countries in general, but we'll go through it. It comes in the middle of a pattern. And you have to ask yourself, is ISIS a reasonable suspect for having put that bomb in Beirut the previous week that had killed 50 people? I think it is. We've now got the conclusion that after, I think, stubbornly and not wisely resisting the obvious, the Russian government has now also said that their airplane over the Sinai was brought down by a bomb placed by ISIS. We have other ones, right? We have the attempt to attack that train from Belgium to France. We have any number of examples, but above all, now we have Paris. And it seems to me that the Paris attacks fit more or less in this pattern. Now, there is the LIHOP side of it, which I'd like to treat perhaps separately. But here's the idea. ISIS is in big trouble. Without understanding this, you may not understand what the motivation is for ISIS to do this kind of stuff. Remember, if we go back to, it's Lucius Cassius Longinus Ravilla, the consul of the Roman Republic in 127 BC, this is the guy who said, cui prodest scelus is fecit, right? The one who benefits from the crime is the perpetrator, or I would say is the prime suspect. This is the famous cui bono analysis. I would say the cui bono is that ISIS is losing. They're on the ropes. They're a paper tiger whose myth of invincibility has been stripped away by the Kurds and by those gallant female Kurds, right? The lady Kurds have done yeoman service in showing that ISIS really is very vulnerable and very mundane and very incompetent when you really get down to it. And obviously, what else can they be? That an anti-human genocide cult simply does not have an attraction to large groups of people, right? To a bunch of marginal sociopaths, okay, but not to the middle class of a large country. It's impossible. So the cui bono is that ISIS is losing. And what we can see specifically how damaging that is for them. And they need victories. They need glory. They need victories. They've got to reacquire that aura of invincibility. The Western media are eager to re-endow them with the aura of invincibility. So they need to attack foreign countries. They need spectacular attacks. And they also need bombastic threats. They need blood-curdling rhetoric that they're going to attack New York and Washington and Rome. I think we need to take all of that with a grain of salt. And we'll be back in just a minute here on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley speaking to you from Washington, D.C. Now, I am taking this opportunity to call your attention to a number of things. First of all, to the daily briefing of the Tax Wall Street Party. It's free. You can subscribe anytime. You can do this through Tarpley.net. If you go to Tarpley.net, you find the text of the daily briefing. Scroll down to the bottom. There's something you can click on, a bar. click on the bar, and you give your email address, and you get the daily briefing then through email. And at the same time, I would also urge you to go to TWSP.us. This is actually the simplest way to do it, also from our point of view. TWSP.us, Tax Wall Street Party.us, which is the Tax Wall Street Party, and that there you get directly. You don't have to click on anything more. You're practically there as soon as you start. So that's the easier of the two. TWSP.us. Get the daily briefing. Now, this past week, because of this emergency, I taped a statement. It's about a 30-minute statement in English and in French. En français. Disponible en français. So that is a series of ideas about what had happened and what should be done. And these are largely what I'm summarizing right now. But this is a video with sound, of course. So it's a film. And it's my address to the French people and also to Americans. What are you going to do about this, right? Enough of the commentary. We need to know what to do. And I do know what to do. Close the ISIS supply corridor between Jarablus on the Euphrates and the area of Afrin and Aleppo. Cut the ISIS supply line. Interdict it. Shut it down. No more traffic. No more oil. No more gasoline. No more ammunition. No more spare parts, no more food, no more fanatical recruits, and destroy ISIS. Destroy ISIS within 1 month. With this, you have solved the refugee crisis in Europe, at least tendentially, and you've also set up a situation where terrorism can be significantly exterminated compared to what it is right now. But now again, why did they do this? And what is the benefit? They need glory. They need victims. They need victories. They've got to show everybody how ferocious they are, how that they're the biggest sociopaths of the lot. Now, the controlled media hide this fact, right? They say, oh, ISIS is expanding. If you look at these Republican presidential candidates, they're insane. As I'll tell you later, I would say this is the week where the Republican Party went from majority reactionary to majority fascist, and in which now the Nazis have more or less stuck their heads up, starting with Trump. Trump and his Nazi triumph of the will. We're sick of this stuff. It's despicable, un-American, and it's going to create a tremendous harvest of hate around the world. A lot of people are going to die because of the loud mouth rhetoric of these Republican scoundrel swine. So we'll get to that, though. But here's the idea. ISIS is losing. ISIS has been defeated in Sinjar by a combination of the Kurds and the U.S. Military aviation. The ISIS line of communications between Mosul, their largest city, and Raqqa, their capital, has been cut because Sinjar has been taken by the Kurds, and a 25-mile stretch of Highway 47 has been seized. So that's a big defeat. It essentially cuts the terrorist caliphate into two parts, right? Again, like taking Vicksburg, just as that cut the Confederacy into two parts. That's the rule of Sinjar. We had that report from Thierry Meyssan last week, and our broadcast was just about the same time as the taping of it, at least, was just about the same time as the Paris terror events. We learned from Thierry that in this Aleppo-Palmyra area, the Russian airstrikes have killed lots of terrorists, and a lot of them have run away. Somehow the glories of martyrdom don't seem quite so attractive when they can come down on your head any time of day. Congratulations to the Russians. The Russians are still running a 10-to-1 superiority over the U.S. in combat sorties. And this week we saw something also highly interesting. We saw Russian long-range bombers clobbering Raqqa. So that's another defeat. In other words, the French have clobbered Raqqa. The Russians are doing so. The U.S., I think, has done a few sorties also, but not enough. So with the 10-to-1 sorties, Russia to the U.S. and the these bombers coming in, we'd have to say that this is hurting. It's hitting ISIS quite hard, right? It's the point where quantity turns into quality. So again, in the Aleppo Hamara area, the terrorist forces, and this is some ISIS, I'm sure, but it's the Nusra and Free Syrian Army and so forth, who have been thoroughly bombed. Thierry's estimate from last week was that there will be a collapse of the entire terrorist rebel position there as the Syrian army moves in with Russian air cover. So anyway, we have a certain amount of convergence, right? If the U.S. and the Kurds take care of Sinjar and the Russians and the Syrian Arab army take care of Aleppo, Palmyra, we don't want to forget Ramadi, which is under siege by the Iraqi army. So it is a kind of offensive that is coordinated, or at least it's emerging as coordinated by design or by coincidence. We also have the famous air base that had been under siege for 2 years, which has also been, the siege has been lifted by the Syrian army with the Russian Air Force backup. The U.S. has also killed the infamous butcher Jihadi John from Great Britain, one of their most famous leaders. So you put that all together, that is defeat. They are being defeated on all fronts. But, of course, the controlled media don't tell you that. And the reason that they have to lash out in this crude way is because they're being defeated on all fronts. So here's, I think, who we can say is behind this, right, the prime suspects and more. First of all, Saudi intelligence. Now here, there's a very clear track record, right? Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia, you'll remember at the end of 2013, went to Moscow and actually threatened Putin. He said, look, if you don't stop supporting Assad and the Syrian government, then we're going to visit terrorism on you. So that was the threat. And then they did it to some extent. Remember, they blew up the Volgograd railway station, the Stalingrad railway station. So the Saudis are not afraid to attack a superpower with terrorism if they feel that their despicable interests are being challenged. And we'll take it from there in the next segment here on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Remember, subscribe to the Tax Wall Street Party Daily Briefing. You go to twsp.us. You can also go to Tarpley.net. One way or the other, get subscription, be well informed, know what's going on. If you don't know that ISIS is being defeated with places like Sinjar, Aleppo, Palmyra, Raqqa, Ramadi, and so forth, then you don't know what's going on. You can't judge why they do what they do. Now, my argument is, I'm saying there has been a phase change in the control over this pool of jihadis in the Middle East, right? These, a lot of these people are the ones who fought in Libya against Gaddafi. They had, in that case, NATO air cover. They were then shipped by the U.S. by Ambassador Stevens, unfortunately, the late Ambassador Stevens, from Libya to Turkey. They were then introduced into northern Syria. Remember that the entire Syrian rebellion is overwhelmingly foreign in origin. Those are fighters from Chechnya, from Saudi Arabia, from Libya, from Algeria, Tunisia, all over. But they were shipped into Syria as a destabilization operation, a CIA secret army. There never was a peaceful phase. The shooting started back in the early 1980s, and it never stopped. So the idea of this halcyon moment when the heroes of democracy and heroines of democracy were in the streets, this is baloney. But now there's been a phase change. At the moment where Austin says, I can only get half a dozen people, then you know that something has changed in the control apparatus, right? The control mechanisms for terrorism have shifted. I would urge you to bear in mind the concept of the Frankenstein's monster. You create it, and it turns on you. This has happened numerous times. Most prominent example is Hitler. Hitler's seizure of power was, of course, financed by Prescott Bush of Brown Brothers Harriman, and I'm sure Montague Norman of the Bank of England, and Thatcher Brown of the Brown Shipley in London. So this was then stoked by the appeasement policies of France and Britain and support for Hitler from the United States, as we've just said. And at a certain time, Hitler cuts loose from his moorings, gets the Hitler-Stalin Pact, and then attacks all these countries in the West, right? Denmark, Norway, then Holland, Belgium, and then France. And at that point, they realized, oh, my God, our Frankenstein's monster has turned on this. Now, maybe today it's not quite so radical, but at least there are large parts of ISIS that have now acquired a kind of relative autonomy, at least vis-a-vis the Western powers, right? The ISIS was the creation of General David Petraeus. It was the Anbar Awakening. It was the Sunni Awakening. This was done by bribery to get them to fight against the Shiites. But now I think the question of who controls whom has to be taken on a case-by-case basis. So Saudi Arabia has a tremendous record. They're the leading state sponsor of terrorism in the world. Not Iran. Not Iran by a long shot. Forget about Iran. They don't even qualify. But the Saudis, yes, because they're the ones with this network of radical mosques, of apocalyptic preachers, and the constant urge to kill the infidels. And of course, the Saudis need to do this for political reasons. If you were a Dark Ages monarchy stuck in the middle of the 21st century, you would have to promote the worst barbarians, the worst enemies of civilization, and unleash them like a cloud of locusts against all of your neighbors and your enemies and so forth. And even if Bandar is no longer at the helm because of his health situation or other things, this is an indispensable component. And as I say, if they're willing to attack Russia, they're willing to do anything. And these are the ones who have been calling for the elimination of Assad, either by diplomacy or by military means. So they're also in the assassination business. Now, Turkey is a similar story. In Turkey, we have numerous public statements by officials of the Turkish government, of the Erdogan Davutoglu government, where they keep saying, we will not allow any power to control the totality of our southern border. They're talking about the Kurds. And in particular, if the Kurds or anybody else tries to close that 100-kilometer, 60-mile corridor between Jarablus on the Euphrates and this Aleppo-Efrin area, we will not ask anybody's permission. We will smash them. Now, that could include the U.S. Special Forces. It almost did at the end of July, as we knew. So that's a threat to the United States from Turkey. So Saudi and Turkey are not afraid to mix it up with a superpower, right? They're that crazy, but they're willing to do it. The other force that I would see at work is the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan. And that's, in particular, Erdogan. Erdogan is sort of the personal union of a lot of these things. He's, of course, the president of Turkey. He's the head of the AK party. He's a big cheese in the Muslim Brotherhood. And he's got, this is the neo-Ottoman insanity, the neo-Ottoman megalomania that infects Erdogan and Davutoglu in particular. They actually want to conquer a large part of northern Syria as a first step towards reconstituting the Ottoman Empire. Now, Ataturk knew that that was suicide, but these people don't get it. So they're also, it's a power that's looking, it's a revisionist power. They want to go back and revise the Treaty of Sèvres, 1919, part of the Peace of Paris. That's the treaty between the victorious Allies on the one hand and the then extinct Ottoman Empire on the other, right? That's the peace to end all peace. That's the origin of this terrible ethnic chaos that you see. But you better keep those countries, huh? Because that's all you've got. You've got to hang on to national governments. Any nation is an ally. Any state is an ally, except not the Islamic State, which is a very peculiar sort of entity. Now, there is, of course, as we have implacably documented, a faction in the Pentagon and the CIA who want to overthrow Assad at all costs. They're hostile to Russia. They're hostile to Iran. We have talked about General Allen, the now gone ISIS czar. It's actually very interesting. Allen was in power until October 23rd. And it was then, just a couple of weeks later, on November 11th, that the U.S. finally mounted the long-awaited offensive against Sinjar. So Allen had to be out for that to happen. And we're glad that he is out. That's a precondition for any positive U.S. response. Now, I would also think about MI6, right? As we said perhaps last week, there's something going on with Perfide Albion. And this has got to do with this parade of very important people, General Sisi of Egypt and Prime Minister Modi of India and the President of China. The British are up to something treacherous and dirty. And I think they say, well, the U.S. are collapsing. They say are. And we've got to fill the void. So we're gonna recreate a kind of a British led bloc, maybe a Sino-British bloc. And as I tried to point out last week, it's important because Mao Zedong got into power because of British support. He was always an admirer of their philosophical radicalism, John Stuart Mill and Bentham and the rest of them, right? So he's their creature. And the fact that he got into power was largely due to the British. So we'll continue on that in the next installment here of World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tuffin here in Washington, D.C. Once again, subscribe to the briefing of the Tax Wall Street Party. Go to Tarpley.net or TWSP.US. That is the Tax Wall Street Party website. So who did it? We're now up to the CIA Pentagon faction that we've been fighting in particular this past summer. MI6, this is a larger scheme, I guess we can say, crackpot scheming to be sure, but the idea, again, that the British are attempting to give the Chinese an advantage against the dollar, this is not a humanitarian thing. This is not going to be good for a lot of people. Again, those who've been wailing the loudest about U.S. domination will be wailing out of the other side of their mouth when they feel the knout of Beijing, right? If you ever imagine working in a factory run by those guys, this doesn't look good. So the other one I would point out is when we say CIA MI6, we've got to say DGSE, right? DGSE. And we'll have to note the fact that it's the General Direction of External Services, right? Direction Générale des Services Extérieurs. So that's the French CIA equivalent. And this is factionalized. I would say it's got to be factionalized along the same lines you see going back to World War II, because these things are, you know, they move very slowly. But specifically in France, you had La Synarchie. You had this group of pro-fascist bankers and industrialists at a very high level. And then you had their operative arm, La Cagoule, the hooded people, who were the sort of the more operative ones, right, who got their hands a bit dirtier. But those characters are still there. And I would say the common denominator of them, although this is harder to document, is this Grand Orient Freemasonry, Le Grand Orient. And we'll talk about that in connection to the French Interior Minister, Cazeneuve, and to one of his predecessors, Claude Guéant, right? You remember that when we had the Mohamed Merah case, we talked about Claude Guéant. That was back in the spring of 2012. So again, this is state-sponsored terrorism, but I don't see a false flag. If the French government says ISIS did it, ISIS says ISIS did it, claiming credit. Now, that's not conclusive, but at least that's something. And we do have this idea that the people in the concert hall, as they were doing their killing, were shouting, "We're killing you because you killed our confrères in Syria and Iraq," right? The French had joined in on the bombing. So I think this is now more a form of irregular warfare between states. It's state-sponsored terrorism, and there will be obviously every attempt will be made to, you know, to obfuscate and to hide what's going on. But fundamentally, we're back to terrorism as irregular warfare, Kitsonian maybe, but irregular warfare of one state or pseudo-state, the ISIS or Islamic State, Daesh, ISIL, Caliphate, so forth, against a well-established nation state, i.e. France. Now, let's look for a second about the media hype. Now, we have to recall always, this term sophisticated was applied to ISIS from the very beginning, from the get-go, back in the summer of last year, 2014. We were told, oh, they're so sophisticated. Their use of the social media is so overwhelmingly sophisticated. And that epithet looked like that had gotten into the Associated Press style book, that whenever you said ISIS, you had to say sophisticated. It's like if you say Amy Schumer, you have to say amazing when there's nothing amazing. In this case, ISIS sophisticated when they're not sophisticated. Not in any fundamental way, and especially not now, not with this. So, what I found very interesting was the same epithet that had always been applied to ISIS was now applied to these shooters and killers in Paris. They were all of a sudden sophisticated. Now, you have to pardon me, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I don't see the sophistication. I think it's very crude, very primitive, very improvised. It's a series of blind terrorist attacks, right? You can't tell who you're killing, you just kill whoever is there. Blind terrorist attacks on soft targets. No high-value targets, right? No Eiffel Tower, no Arc de Triomphe, no nothing, right? No cube, no pyramid at the Louvre, nothing like that. No World Trade Center, no Pentagon, no Madrid trains, right? None of this stuff. No, what was that? That square near Tavistock where the 7/7 stuff went off in Great Britain in 2005. They can't do any of that. Here's what they do. They send three psychotic patsies to the stadium, right, the Stade de France in northern Paris, and they've all got suicide vests, and I guess some of them have got Kalashnikovs, right? Now, it seems to be the case that they used a very unstable kind of chemical, which may have causes some surprises. I don't know if there's any real finding about that. And of course, with all this stuff, you got to take everything cum grano salis. Man, oh man, you've got to be skeptical. So, you know, a lot of this stuff I advance with many caveats, right? Practically with trepidation. You just can't believe it. But the attack on the stadium is a complete failure. There's a stadium with what, 70,000 people in it, a huge stadium. And if you were going to kill people, man, that's where you had to be. And you had the president of France in there. And you had the foreign minister of Germany, Steinmeier, was there. And, all kinds of TV was trained on that. They couldn't get in. These psychotic patsies from the Saint-Denis cell, I guess, they said, how are we going to get in? They found that they didn't have tickets. Well, that's not very smart, is it? You better get your tickets in advance, or otherwise you better, you know, wait. But they said, we can't wait because we're collapsing. So they got to go in, and they said, well, what we'll do is we'll wait until the largest number of people are entering, right? The rush hour of people going to the game, and we'll mingle in there, and we'll try to rush through, and then we'll be able to detonate and have a lot of victims. Except They got there too late, so they didn't buy the tickets, and then they got there too late. This is pathetic. This is the gang that couldn't shoot straight. They're not sophisticated. And then, I'm afraid, most of the rest of it is simply a glorified drive-by shooting. It's vehicles with people with Kalashnikovs in the vehicles, and they're shooting out of the windows of these cars, right? We know the SEAT, S-E-A-T, I think, the Volkswagen Polo, both black and maybe a third car. So they go on a shooting spree as a drive-by shootings in the streets of Paris. And they met, you know, they kill a significant number of people. They focus on these outdoor cafes, the terraces, right? They stop and they shoot at cafes on two sides of the street. It's only when they get to the concert hall that they finally manage to kill a significant number of people. And more than half of the entire death toll is in the concert hall. So I don't see any particular sophistication. And the idea that they all start at once, I guess, but that's very minimal. There's no particular technical aspect. The attack on the stadium is a complete failure. They don't kill anybody inside the stadium. They're only able to kill themselves. What kind of a suicide bomber can be happy if there's no death toll other than the suicide bomber himself or herself? Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome to the second half of our edition of World Crisis Radio. It's the 20th of November here in the afternoon in Washington, D.C., and we are talking about the Paris terrorist attacks of just about exactly 1 week ago, almost to the hour, and what this means about the dynamics of terrorism and also about the entire international scene. Now, our principal point in the last segment was anytime you hear a media hound, a prostitute, telling you that this was a sophisticated action, that person is unfortunately either a dupe or an agent of some intelligence agency that has a vested interest in purveying fear. And remember, this question of purveying fear is so institutionalized now. It is so much the automatic Pavlovian knee-jerk response of these press people, the reporters and so forth, that you have to realize that they're going to respond to these events unless and until they get very strict orders to change their tone. This is how they're going to play it. So it's very crude. And I regard the fact that they were calling ISIS sophisticated and still do. And they call these primitive and really poorly organized shooters and bombers, right, who fail. One leg of their attack is a complete failure. The most important one, with the biggest pool of possible victims, they just don't get anywhere near any target. If you call that sophisticated, there's something wrong with you. Now, there were a few people on France 24 this week who, you know, rebelled against this notion of how sophisticated. Now, here's another aspect, right? The French police, unfortunately, are rather dirty. They are factionalized, and at the leadership level in particular. Here's what they have managed to do. This character, Abaoud, who was killed in the siege of the apartment in Saint-Denis, right? Saint-Denis, a little bit north of Paris, that famous basilica, right? The first really high Gothic church, right, by Abbé Suger, S-U-G-E-R, the guy who built it, the tremendous importance of the role of light, right, la lumière, inside this this building. Well, in Saint-Denis now, this is a rundown working class suburb of Paris. So this Abaoud was apparently killed, or they now say he was killed, in that firefight, which I believe was from Tuesday morning into Wednesday. So he was the one who knew relatively the most, right? This is the story they tell. He had been traveling to Syria, and then he came back. And the French police knew about him. He was very much among the usual suspects. but they somehow didn't prevent him from going to Syria, and then they lost track of him when he was in Syria, and then when he came back, they didn't know, and he had been there for a while, and then he's regarded as the organizer or mastermind. Now, I would say the mastermind is probably back in some place like Raqqa or something like this, but why did the French police have to kill this guy above all? Because this is now suspicious. We have discovered a pattern. If we go back to the case of Mohamed Merah, M-E-R-A-H, you'll remember that Merah was the guy who went on a shooting spree in, I think, March of 2012. It's very suspicious timing. Just as the French presidential election campaign got underway, as I recall, Sarkozy was unpopular. He needed an event like this. Merah delivered. He killed some French military people, right, some soldiers out on leave. And Merah then also attacked a Jewish school. So that entire infamy was attached to him. He gave some interviews. Eventually, he was holed up in a house. He was still giving interviews, and at a certain point, the place was stormed, and he was killed. So the impression we're getting is that the policy of the French police is to kill important witnesses, so you never get the vital testimony. Merah, of course, was somebody who had been exposed as an official informant, practically a stringer of the DGSE, the intelligence agency. And we want to remember the name of a certain Claude Guéant, G-U-E, accent aigu, A-N-T. Claude Guéant. We'll talk about him, but that guy has just been sentenced to jail time, although suspended, and a rather large fine for embezzling money. But this is these entrenched bureaucrats, right? Entrenched French several civil service bureaucrats, right? Many graduating from the École Nationale de l'Administration, the Grande École of the ENARC, right? The bureaucrats, right? The Grand Commis d'État. So it turned out that Mohamed Merah, who had killed the French soldiers and attacked the Jewish school and killed lots of people, was in fact officially a stringer, right? Semi-official, whatever, of the French intelligence service, DGSE, and that they had sent him all around the Middle East to build up his credibility and to do other tasks, I'm sure. But then he was killed. And then in the Charlie Hebdo, we find that the principal patsy is there, and that is the Kouachi brothers and Koulibaly. That group of three, as soon as the entire thing began to wind down, they were all killed. So the French police are 0 for 3 in stopping these terrorist attacks, but they're batting 1,000. They're 3 for 3 in making sure that the witnesses, the principal witnesses, get killed. So that is very suspicious, and we're wondering about, you know, what's going on with this stuff. There's also the story of this woman. This woman, if these biographical details are accurate, right, the woman who was apparently, she blew herself up, according to the initial reports, even until yesterday, they were reporting that this woman had blown herself up with a suicide vest in the Saint Denis apartment. We have pictures of her in suggestive poses, right? She doesn't wear a veil. She doesn't wear much of anything. She's vivacious. She's flirtatious. She's a kind of a femme fatale, I guess. And then she supposedly blows herself up, and now they say, no, none of that is true. This reminds me of Atta, right? You remember Mohammed Atta, who supposedly piloted the first plane that hit the North Tower? He was known to consort with prostitutes. He was known to take drugs. He went to the discotheque, drank alcohol, complete hedonistic, westernized, decadent existence. This woman, according to some reports, had been herself a prostitute or a rapper yet. So she was definitely deeply compromised with the rotten, decadent culture of the West. But now then she supposedly turns into somebody so so fanatical that she's willing to blow herself up. There's some stuff that doesn't make sense here. So what I would think about this is the following, right? Now, in 9/11, we had the big debate on the overall nature of the action. Is it MIHOP? Is it that some agency or force made it happen on purpose, which is the one that I found to be accurate? Or is it LIHOP? Quite a number of authors, the most of all, right? This was the most popular, other than, you know, the lesser ones like Unanswered Questions. The ones who said, let it happen on purpose, in the case of 9/11, were wrong, because there was nobody out there who could do it. But now, in this case, I think we have to look at LIHOP as something that the evidence seems to be pointing to. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. It's the afternoon of Friday, the 20th of November, just 1 week after these Paris terrorist attacks. So, the French police have this knack for killing all the important witnesses. This is very suspicious. They can't make up their mind about this woman. Did she blow herself up or not? So that has to be looked into. There is no doubt that this is, from the official point of view, a tremendous bureaucratic failure. And it's all the more embarrassing because the same cast of characters had the Charlie Hebdo case thrown at them in or something else, right? But anyway, the Charlie Hebdo occurred in the first week of January. And after that, the French government was supposed to introduce all of these vast, sweeping reforms to make sure that could never happen again. And now somehow all of that is forgotten. I think probably the British journalist on NPR this morning saying the French had done nothing. That may be exaggerated, but it was not effective. Remember my constant admonition, don't take away the civil rights and political rights of the people unless and until you have installed a mole detector at the Interior Ministry and the DGSE and the DGRI. I think the domestic one is called the old Renseignement Général, Renseignement Intérieur, I guess at this point. You need to put a mole detector in those places. All right? So it's les taupes, la vieille taupe. There used to be a bookshop in Paris called La Vieille Taupe, which I had attended, right? It was undoubtedly an intelligence drop for many. I was looking for books. I think that the story of why the French can't block these attempts is somehow to be found in a book on the shelves of La Vieille Taupe, because this seems to be the big issue that, again, the administration is factionalized. In the past, it was the La Synergie and La Cagoule and the Grand Orient. There are also a couple of other Freemasonic currents, groups, organizations, which I'm sure have their rivalries. So, again, what if ISIS does this? It's sort of a motu proprio. In other words, they are the driving force, right? ISIS says, oh my God, we've got to step up our recruiting. We've got to show that we're just as ferocious as ever. Let's attack Paris. Let's threaten Washington. Let's threaten New York. Let's threaten Rome, the pillars of the Western world. And then maybe we can refurbish, right? We can burnish our terrorist image, they would say, and recruit all sorts of people, would say ISIS. So here's the other problem. Bernard Cazeneuve. So it's the Interior Ministry. It's written C-A-Z-E-N-E-U-V-E. He is the Interior Minister. And in the case of France and these other countries, the interior minister is not like the Secretary of the Interior here in the U.S., who is somebody who worries about forests and minerals and mining and things like that. It is the police minister. It's the internal security minister. In other words, if terrorism occurs, the buck stops with him. The buck goes to Bernard Cazeneuve, and it stops there. And in the past, France, like many other countries, had a system which was called ministerial responsibility. And it simply meant that if a debacle, a catastrophic event, occurred on your watch, you had to resign. And there's very good reason for this, which I will now try to explain. As the world has become more oligarchical, and as the oligarchs have banded together, essentially, against their own people and against reality, the principle of ministerial responsibility has fallen into desuetude. It's not practiced anymore. It's passé. It's quaint, I guess they would say. Here we have Cazeneuve. He was in charge in the first week of January when the Charlie Hebdo occurred. He promised to institute those sweeping reforms. Now we see that the reforms have amounted to nothing, and yet he's still there. And what does he do now? He does not have the decency to resign, but he says, I want more power. Now, this is crazy. The principle of ministerial responsibility, and I've summed this up many times, but I think people still need to hear it. There are countries where if the national soccer team loses a big game, the sports minister must resign. If there's a big railway crash and lots of people get killed, the transportation minister must resign. All the more in a case like this, I'm amazed to see that Cazeneuve is still the interior minister of France, but maybe I shouldn't be surprised. Here in the United States, we have the parallel, the precursor, right, the precedent of John Ashcroft. So here we have a thoroughly incompetent bureaucratic bungler who was in power on September 11, 2001. And his response to this was to demand the Patriot Act and what we have to call liberticide laws. This is a good word. Learn it. Liberticide. It's an adjective, or it can be a liberticide, like a homicide, a fratricide, a liberticide. The act of killing freedom, of destroying freedom. And liberty. So, that's what Ashcroft did. He said, I want liberticide laws. And of course, what this amounts to is Ashcroft or Cazeneuve now saying, the more I fail, the more power you have to give me. Let me fail again so I can get more power. This is absolutely insane. The reason that ministerial responsibility started out is to maintain some modicum of public confidence in the government. In other words, an oligarch like Ashcroft or Cazeneuve, they have to know that if they let this happen, either through negligence or through ill will, right, through criminal intent, they will be fired. There's no two ways about it. You can't do it any other way. Otherwise, you get into this dilemma of the guy saying, yeah, I failed, but now I want more power. It's simply impossible. Up to the point, obviously, of having a dictatorship. In other words, the idea is if you get rid of me, I'll fight all the way to a dictatorship. Now, so those are some of the things about this. Some of them, I think, come down on the MIHOP side. Some of them on the LIHOP side. I think there's a significant faction in France that wants to let these things happen for their own reasons, but I think it is let them. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. My, how the time flies. This is now segment 7 of our broadcast here on Friday, the 20th of November, as we're recording. I was just going through why Bernard Cazeneuve, under the usual system of ministerial responsibility, this current interior minister of France, should have resigned. Of course, Ashcroft, the Ashcroft case here in the U.S. was even more éclatant, right, even more blatant, and he did not resign. Now, let's just look. What's with these French security official types, right? Are they mixed in with the Marseille drug mafia, or maybe the Grand Orient Freemasons, or maybe the Cagoule in its current form? Claude Guéant, I mentioned him before. Claude Guéant was at various times chief of staff to President Nicolas Sarkozy. He participated in running the French government. Claude Guéant was also the interior minister of France between February 2011 and May 2012. So this Merah case comes towards the end of his tenure as interior minister, right? The Merah case, I think, was in March of 2012, and then Guéant was out as interior minister in May of 2012. And I guess that's the change in the government, right? That's the election of Hollande, more or less. So, just recently now, on October 8th, 2015, a month or little more ago, Claude Guéant was convicted of embezzlement, and he, along with five prefects, right, prefects of police, right, these French officials who, you know, they run the police in a département, I guess it is. Guéant and five prefects were convicted of embezzlement, and they were sentenced to 30 months in jail, but they got off with a suspended sentence, right? Then they didn't have to go to jail. And each of them got, I think, a 75,000 euro fine for embezzlement. So the predecessor of the Cazeneuve, Guéant, was lucky to escape jail. So this is all very, very strange. And I hope people in France will be interested. Also, this question of the three Freemasonic groups, right? The Grand Orient, the Grand Lodge of France, and the National Grand Lodge of France. We need to learn more about that. At any rate, the outcome is that President Hollande of France is now on a diplomatic offensive, which could be a positive thing, could be. If he tries to organize the great powers, the U.S. and Russia, to join with France and maybe Germany or some others, to go in and attack Assad, that will be insane. And the key role of Putin in this is to make sure that does not happen. We note that this week, Putin, speaking to a group of Russian generals, said, I want you, generals who are running the Russian presence in Syria, the Eastern Mediterranean, the Levant, I want you to cooperate with the French as with an ally. On that same day, the Pentagon spokesman, this guy Cook, came out and said, no, we don't want any part of that because we want to overthrow Bashar al-Assad. That is criminal insanity. The guy who also has to be fired is Ashton Carter, the utopian pedant of essentially warfare, a tremendous menace to the future of the United States. So, Hollande will be here in Washington, D.C. on the 24th of November, goes on to Moscow at the 26th of November. He wants to have a grand alliance against terrorism. United States should join. United States should be leading it. But we have Allen and Petraeus, and we have all of these careers that depend on getting rid of Assad. All of those careers have to end. The American people can't be dragged into more war because of this absurd obsession against Assad and this absurd predilection for these terrorists, right? The moderate terrorists, the Al-Qaeda, who are now the moderates. Okay, so here's the other thing. Kerry, as a result of one of the Vienna talks, Kerry is saying that there should be a peace process beginning. Here's the problem. There must be no ceasefire with ISIS in the sense that no territory, not one human being, must be left under the yoke of the fanatical genocidal cult called ISIS. You can't leave people under the control of those butchers, and then they can systematically kill them while the world looks on aghast. No. Nor can you turn to Nusra, Free Syrian Army, the 300 sects sectlets, splinter groups, and so forth. They are all reeling under the Russian bombing. All of them want a ceasefire. We need military victory. In other words, we need a military solution as against against ISIS. I recommend the study, the telegram sent by General Ulysses Grant to the Confederate commander Floyd at Fort Donelson back in early 1862. You get the idea, right? No terms other than unconditional and immediate surrender will be accepted. I propose to move immediately upon your works, your fortifications. So we need military victory. What I'm reminded of is the thing with the Tamil Tigers, right? When the Tamil Tigers were rather terroristic, when they were reeling, they were about to be destroyed. This was in, I think, 2009 in the springtime. It became clear that the Western powers had been supporting the Tamil Tigers all along, practically in an anti-Chinese function. As soon as it was clear that the Tamil Tigers were going to be wiped out, the British Foreign Secretary Miliband and the French Foreign Secretary, the French Foreign Minister, Kouchner, they ran in, they said, oh, we've got to have a ceasefire. The ceasefire was to protect those butchers. So yes to the world bloc. Hollande is asking for it. That's good. Russian diplomacy has been seeking that bloc for the past year or more. That's the whole purpose of Russian diplomacy, is to assemble a worldwide bloc that could essentially reinvigorate the UN Security Council and allow a solution. But the key thing has to be work with existing governments, unless they're ISIS, of course, which is no government. But work with Assad, work with the Syrian government. We have always been on this line for the past four or five years, and that remains the key. Now, let's look at the domestic ramifications here in the U.S. This is, I think, an absolutely appalling spectacle. This is the week when the Republican Party essentially went fascist and embraced bigotry and essentially the Nazi race science, I would say. They have now gone way too far. And I welcome it because I think this can now be the prelude to the collapse of the Republican Party. Now, there are two issues for the Republicans. One is, what do you want to do about Syria? And the other question is, can we have some number, right, be it 65,000 or 100,000 Syrian refugees that can be settled here in the United States? And I say, yes, you certainly can. And that does not constitute a risk. And indeed, not doing it would be a risk. In other words, if the United States gets up there and says, officially, in the eyes of the world, we are an Islamophobic power, this is grave damage to American national security and the whole standing of the United States in the world. It is intolerable, and it must not happen. And we'll be back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. We're hurrying along here on November 20th. Let's look at the fascistization of the Republican Party. This is going to go down in history as the week that a qualitative shift in the direction of outright fascism, with already significant points of actual Nazism, have occurred in the Republican Party. And some of it has got to do with the no-fly zone, and some of it has got to do with the question of the Syrian refugees, right? Who are, and this is not a large amount, right? Not compared to the hundreds of thousands that have streamed into Germany. Plus, the United States is the classical immigration country, right? Wir sind das klassische Einwanderungsland, the classical country that you immigrate to. And New York City, in particular, from whence I hail, is the biggest factory of assimilation in the world. And if we just had a decent economy with a decent labor market, we could easily assimilate lots and lots of people. So instead of that, we have Ben Carson talking about, if there's a rabid dog running around in your neighborhood, a mad dog, I would say the mad dog is old Ben, unstable as he is, you're probably not going to assume something good about that dog, and you put your children away. This is the level of the argument. You can rack that up against Dr. Goebbels any day. Who else do we have here? Donald Trump, of course. He's always out in front. He wants to close the mosques. He wants to register Muslim citizens. This is flagrant violation of the U.S. Constitution. Flagrant. Register, force people to register? My God, this is like the Nuremberg laws in the Germany in the 1930s, right? Under Hitler, let's get it straight. He also wants to, other punitive, measures, right? No doubt about Trump. So close the mosques and register the people. Persecute them, take away their money so they can't send it to their relatives, on and on. In the case of, we've got some governors that have been in action. Greg Abbott of Texas is trying to outdo Governor Snyder of Michigan in the xenophobic, bigoted, and hate-filled measures. They want to cut off payments that are ultimately federal payments, but that go through state bureaucracies, right? They want to harass the huddling masses yearning to feel to be free. So you've got an orgy of racist rhetoric from the Republicans about these groups, and they have no proof. In other words, there's no track record of terrorist activities or significant criminal activities coming from Syrians that have already been let in. Ironically, Syria is the most tolerant country. Remember, they have Shiites, they have Alawites, they have Sunnis, they have Kurds, they have Druzes, they have all different kinds. And the entire purpose of the Syrian state is to harmonize them, right? As this was told to me in particular by the Grand Mufti of Damascus, with whom I met when I was there. This is Dr. Husseini, and he said, you have to understand, we are the last bastion of tolerance, inclusion, and diversity in the entire Middle East. And those guys out there, those fanatics, be they Nusra or ISIS, simply kill Christians, kill Alawites, kill Druzes, whatever you want. They'll just mow you down. Yazidis, and so forth. So it's a genocidal cult. Trump says, we're going to have to do certain things that were frankly unthinkable a year ago. This is how fascism creeps in, says Trump. We're going to have to look at the mosques. We're going to have to look very, very carefully. He would create a database of Muslims in the United States, certainly. There should be a lot of systems beyond databases. I mean, we should have a lot of systems. Well, this is simply appalling. Now, who else do we have? Little Rand Paul, in his doomed and moribund campaign, has again alienated the libertarians on this point. He is trying to tail after Trump and Carson, and he wants to. Seize on the Syrian refugee issue, and he's more focused on the refugees than on the problem in the Middle East. Paul offered an amendment blocking housing benefits for refugees from 34 countries, including Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran. And it didn't come up for a vote. Now, let me hasten to point out, the House of Representatives, with far too many Democratic votes, far too many Democrats voted for this. The House of Representatives has now passed a rather nasty piece of rhetoric about how the Syrian refugees should be persecuted. But Harry Reid in the Senate says he will make sure it dies there, and I'm sure Obama will also veto it. But this now sets up the government shutdown and indeed the default in December. In the middle of December, when this stuff gets added to the defense appropriations bill, and the Republicans say they're going to have not just the war on women with this attack on Planned Parenthood, but also the war on the helpless Syrian refugees, right? These nasty vermin, they're going to threatened, they're going to shut down the whole U.S. government in the name of this. Now, how about Rubio? We need to talk more about Rubio. This is in the Politico. They say, we asked Marco Rubio to lay out his ISIL strategy. Here it is. And this is nothing short of World War III. Hold on to your hats. Here's Rubio, Senator Marco Rubio, number three in quite a few of the polls on the Republican side. Cutting off oxygen to ISIL, ISIS, Daesh, also requires defeating Assad in Syria. How do you get that? He's the one fighting them. I would declare no-fly zones to ground Assad's Air Force and coalition-controlled safe zones. He says, I declare no-fly zones to ground Assad's Air Force and coalition-controlled safe zones in the country to stop his military. This is the Erdogan method. These safe zones would stem the flow of refugees and provide a place to train and arm rebel fighters, moderate terrorists. Are we serious? $500 million down the drain and he wants to keep doing it? And now here's the kicker. I would oppose Russia and Iran in their fight to prolong Assad's brutal regime. Up to what point? Up to World War III? The person is mad. Get him a canvas blazer. Get him a straitjacket. Get him in a padded cell. He's nuts. He's a national menace. Now, more sophisticated, Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton is the only Democrat who wants to have a no-fly zone. And remember her problem? If she's not the biggest hawk on the scene, she's going to be attacked as a weak woman, is what goes through her obfuscated head. So that's her, right? She's relatively inclusive on the refugees, but she wants to escalate. A no-fly zone means a comprehensive U.S. bombing campaign all over Syria. Are you going to bomb the Russian base? If some Syrian planes take refuge on the Russian base, are you going to follow them there and start World War III? You are nuts. This woman is so weak. And she tries to disguise it because she overcompensates. That's what it usually is. Now, interesting, though, in Hillary's speech, the former Secretary of State was unsparing in criticizing U.S. allies Turkey and Saudi Arabia, along with Qatar and other Gulf Arab states, for facilitating extremism and looking the other way. Facilitating extremism is giving material support to terrorism. Our efforts will only succeed if the Arabs and Turks step up in a much bigger way. This is their fight, and they need to act like it. She was toughest on Turkey, a NATO ally. That's a laughingstock. Turkey must finally seal its border with Syria. There it is. Seal the border with Syria. We're for it. Over which most jihadi recruits cross and stop bombing Kurdish rebel forces in the Islamic State. Now, last Sunday, Kerry was on CNN and said, we're working with the Turks to close that infamous Jarablus to Aleppo corridor. But of course, with Turkey, it won't happen without a big fight. So we say, fight that big fight. And I think we have reached the end of our final segment. So we thank you for tuning in. Remember, to keep up with all of this day by day, subscribe to the daily briefing of the Tax Wall Street Party. Go to twsp.us and, of course, at parpley.net. You can see the whole thing. You can see my Twitter feed. You can see the daily briefing. And indeed get access to some of these books that I cited, like 9/11. See you next week.